that at the beginning of his public life, Jesus was 30 years of age. And what he did at that time, when he was 30 and he was about to begin his public life, to begin his preaching, to begin the selection of the apostles, he went away for what the gospel tells us is 40 days. Biblical scholars tell us that 40 days does not mean 40 days. If you remember, if you go through the Bible, you remember all the things that happened for 40 days, like during the flood it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. 40 was a Semitic way of saying an acceptable amount of time. So we don't know what that was. But Jesus went on a 40-day fast. He went out to pray and to fast. He wanted to prepare for his active life by gathering together inside of him all of his forces. And at the end of the 40 days, we have the narration of the temptations of Jesus. He was tempted to do three things, and he rejects them. And I would like to try to explain the temptations of Jesus in terms of the clarification of a life principle. They say that if someone ever tells you, I just did this or I just did that, I don't know why, the one thing you can be sure of is that there was a motive. He didn't just do it. He says, well, this is me. Oh, no, it's not just you. It's you for a reason. Now, all of us, no matter how we live, are seeking something. We have a life principle. That means we have a general motive or direction that influences our whole life. Now, it's strange that the three things that Jesus was tempted to do was concerned with pleasure, power, and the avoidance of responsibility. And it's rather interesting that three of the leading psychiatrists in the history of psychology have suggested that the three motives for which men act, no matter what they tell you, are pleasure, power, and the avoidance of responsibility. The devil took Jesus up on the mountain, and he said to him, you're hungry. You've been fasting for 40 days and 40 nights. You see these rocks? I will turn them into bread for you so you can eat if you will worship me. And Jesus rejects this. Get away from me. I will give you pleasure. I am not out for pleasure. Get away from me. Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. And the devil takes Jesus up onto the pinnacle of the temple, and he says, you see all those nations out there? See those blinking lights out there of the nations of the world? I will give you rule over all of them. I will give you power over all men if you will worship me. And Jesus rejects the second temptation of power. And the devil takes Jesus back to the mountain. He says, well, then throw yourself off the mountain and let your Father catch you. And Jesus rejects this temptation. What they say in talking about a life principle is that when you have a principle and you say, I'm out for my pleasure, and some men do adopt this as their life principle, then when they come to a specific circumstance, a daily event, they don't have to ask any questions about what they want to do. They simply ask one question: what gives me the most pleasure? And they do it. They follow the course that brings them the most pleasure. Now, the first of the great modern psychiatrists, Sigmund Freud, said that it is pleasure that man will always follow. No matter what he does, he's seeking his own pleasure. Always. That's the pleasure principle of Sigmund Freud. If a man is living a good life, and he's giving generously of himself, and you say to Dr. Freud, is he living for the pleasure principle? The self-sacrificing life? He's so sure. Sure he is. That's the way he gets his pleasure. That's the way he gets his kicks. By doing, he's a do-gooder. He's a real born Boy Scout or Girl Scout. All he's doing is that's where he gets his pleasure. But that's, Freud said, what rules every man's life. Pleasure. Whether it be physical pleasure, sexual pleasure, or maybe some kind of a spiritual pleasure. He does things for other people, but not for the other person, but because he feels good doing it. He gets his pleasure that way. When the devil offers Jesus this, what Jesus is doing is he's clarifying his life principle at the beginning of his public life. He's clarifying this whole, the whole deeper meaning of this temptation narrative in the scriptures is, are you going to live for pleasure? And Jesus says, no. Get away from me. The second of the great psychiatrists, a man named William Adler, who was originally Freud's disciple but broke off from him, he said, no, it really isn't. The reason the way men act, whatever they do, really isn't pleasure. Adler said, everybody has an inferiority complex. It's like a big gaping hole inside you, and every man is trying to fill that. And what he tries to fill it with is power. The real struggles that go on in men's lives are not for pleasure. They're for power. When a man seduces a woman, it isn't for the physical pleasure of the seduction. There's something much deeper than that. He wants to have power over her. When people manipulate one another, It's a struggle for power. And very often males in our culture try to manipulate by getting angry, by raising their voice. General Bull Moose has declared. Whereas women, Adler said, try to manipulate more often through weakness, which is, of course, even more subtle and effective manipulation, isn't it? By a tear. Obviously, the most controlling person in any family is the baby. People say, shh, the baby's sleeping. Herman, get up. The baby is crying. It's time for the baby's food. So that some people, in order to gain power over others, actually assume a mask of weakness, because that can be the most effective way to manipulate people, by being weak. So that Adler says, whether you use the weapons of weakness or the armor of strength, what men in their interaction are really out for is power. The devil says to Jesus, I will give you all these nations to rule. I will give you power over all the men in these cities that you see, if you will fall down and adore me. And Jesus says, I am not out for power. I don't want power. I don't want rule over the kingdoms of this world. Be gone, Satan. In our own time, there are two psychiatrists who who has said that both Freud and Adler are wrong, that man does not have a free will, and that what determines men's action is their programming. And these men are named Watson and B.F. Skinner. And Skinner recently, within the last 5 years, has created a great amount of attention by his book, Beyond Human Dignity and Freedom. He says man is simply not free. In the very first years of life, a baby is programmed to do whatever he does the rest of his life. In other words, in the first couple years of life, by whoever your influences are, presumably your parents, and most emphatically your mother, she imprints upon you what are called parent tapes. You have a tape recorder in your head that's constantly playing, constantly telling you who you are, what you are to do, and so forth. And so your life, according to these determinists, Skinner and Watson and a whole group of people, behavioral scientists in general, tend to this, you program people. And what you really are is a phonograph record. The record is already printed. The record is already stamped. And the only thing that lies ahead of you is the spinning out of the record. In other words, you don't bear any responsibility really for your life because you aren't free and you might as well face it. Now, I think if I told you what Skinner proposes, you'd have a little trouble with it. But when people get very learned, it sometimes seems they get very out of touch with reality. You know, sometimes if you ever envy the world of academe, don't worry about it. There are a lot of real flakes up there in those ivory towers. Skinner says, let's take babies away from their parents. Because parents always mess up the programming. And educate some pros who really know how to program a person to be mild, to be creative, to be peaceful, to be law-abiding, and so forth. Let's take it out of the hands of the amateurs and put it in the hands of the pros. So we have baby farms for those first 2 years of life in which those babies are programmed. Because man isn't free. And it's a strange thing that when Skinner is asked, was your life programmed? Did your parents program into you that you would come out with this theory, that you would write your books? He says, oh, yes, clearly. Mm-hmm. He himself put his little daughter in a glass cage. She spent a lot of her childhood in a glass box. She's now in teaching, I think, in the East somewhere. Say she's a very shy girl, not too well adjusted socially. But Skinner is very popular, you know? Are you really free? Now, all of these men, Freud, Adler, and all their disciples, and Watson and Skinner, they have a point. It's hard to be totally wrong. It's hard to be totally right. And the point is, I suppose, is that our programming does really influence us, but we still always maintain a lever of freedom. Whatever your parents told you, whatever they drilled into you about yourself, about other people, about life, obviously influences you a great deal. It would be foolish to deny this. The imprint of parents on a child, the child's reaction to the parents, it isn't what the parents were saying necessarily, but what the child heard, is very important. But if you ever believe this, that you are completely programmed, then let the record spin out and see what happens. You lose all sense of your capacity to change. One of the great psychiatrists of our times, a Jewish psychiatrist from Vienna, Viktor Frankl, says that the most important thing psychiatry could possibly do for the next 50 years is impress man with his, the powers of his spirit to change, to grow. You're never beyond change. To stimulate the defiant powers of the human spirit, you can do it. And oh, how I believe in that. I believe in that very strongly for myself and for you. The one thing I hate most to hear from anybody is, this is the way I was in the beginning, am now, and ever shall be. And I want to say, oh, no. No, don't ever say that. You can change. I'm changing. God is not finished with me yet, but I'm gonna really change. I tell my students at Loyola, when by the time your kids get to Loyola, there's going to be a saintly priest walking around here, and everybody will call him the saint, me. Because God's going to make me a saint. You wait and see. I'm going to change. I'm not much now, baby. But wait till you see me. Wait till you see what's to come. Because I'm going to change. I really believe this with every muscle and fiber and brain cell of my being. I can change, and so can you. But there is a strong current in modern psychology of a kind of computerized behavioral scientism that says, no, sorry. It's all over, baby. You were programmed to be what you are, and that's what you're going to be. The record will spin itself out, and Jesus says, no. I will not throw myself off the mountain and let my Father catch me. I will not give up responsibility. You know the type of person who acts according to this third life principle of determinism? The person who says, well, let's see what happens. Or when a person tells me, I've got a problem, and I say, fine, you do have a problem. What are you going to do about it? And they say, geez, I don't know. We'll see what happens. They live in a way that says Skinner is right. Throw yourself off the mountain and let your Father catch you. Oh, no. No, Jesus says. He refuses to avoid that kind of responsibility, to make his decisions, to make his choices, to suffer and to endure and to be exhilarated in his own life. No, I will not do that. Which of those three do you think is more predominant in American culture today? Do you think that we are a pleasure-bent society? Do you think Sigmund Freud would be right for most men, as you know? Do they do what brings them most pleasure? Or would you say that Adler is probably right, that most men adopt as their life principle, which they apply in individual circumstances, their life principle is power. What they really are doing constantly is manipulating other people, trying to exercise some form of supremacy, whether it be through weakness, obvious weakness, or obvious strength. Or would you say that most men let life roll over them? They say, this is the way I am. Sorry. Was this way in the beginning, am now, and ever shall be. Well, we'll see what happens. I know that I'm not going to decide my life anyway. You either get the breaks or you don't. Either you're there at the right time and the right place or you're not. But you can hear them giving up responsibility for changing, for growing. They talk a lot about what happened in the past to me. Well, you know, I really wasn't loved as a child. As though, well, that's the end of my story. Or I made some mistakes in my life. As though, well, now that I've made those mistakes, there's not much future for me. This is determinism. And Jesus says, no. No to pleasure. No to power as a life principle. No to determinism. And yes to love. The whole point of a life principle is this, that once you adopt a life principle, you don't have to agonize over individual decisions. You only have to ask yourself, What will give me the most pleasure, if that is your principle? Where will I get the most power, if that is your principle? How can I best avoid any decisions and responsibilities, if that is your principle? Or what is the most loving thing to do, if Christ's principle is yours? Jesus says, I did not come to be served, I came to serve. I'm the divine physician. I didn't come for those who are well, but for those who are sick, to help them, to love them. Unconditionally, to love them. And so he started out as a rabbi with only one thought, only one principle, and that is the principle of loving service. How can I help you? That's the question he asks, whoever he meets. And different people obviously have different answers. So the person who's loving has to be very empathetic. He has to try to feel what the other person is feeling in order to supply whatever is needed by that person at that moment. Love is really tough. Love is a very tough reality because it asks you, first of all, to get out of yourself. Instead of asking people, what are you going to do for me? When you look at an individual person, you have to lose your attention. You have to break the fixation with yourself and send your attention out there to watch that person. Because each person has a different need, and those needs are constantly changing. I remember one time being very impressed when I was at a party held by a couple that has been married for maybe 35 years, and a man was serving drinks and singing, and his wife whispered to me, he isn't feeling well. And I looked at her and I said, has he been sick long? And she said, no, he just got sick about 15 minutes ago. I said, how did you know? And she laughed and she said, I'm his wife. I love him. And I knew that they had not talked in the last 15 minutes. He didn't tell her. She was watching him and she knew. And I was watching him and I didn't know. He looked very happy to me. I thought if he acts this way when he's sick, what would he be like if he were well? So I sidled up to the man and I said, hey, old buddy, how you doing? And he said, not too well. About 15 minutes ago, he said, I started to feel bad. He said, I had a kidney infection a couple of months ago, and I think I might be getting a recurrence. And I'll never forget that night. I'll never forget what she said. She said, I'm his wife. I know. What that means is she was watching him. The way love watches. Love is always asking, what do you need? What do you need today? Empathy means to feel with the other person what he's feeling. Love involves a person in 1,000 decisions. How can I help you? What do you need? Where do you hurt? When I think about myself as a growing person, that God is working with me and that I am evolving and that I'm learning to love, I really am. I don't think of myself as a great lover, but I'm learning. And I remember the first time I went into a classroom and I was so scared. They told us, do not smile before Christmas. If you walk into a classroom and say, hi, boys, they will take your pants off. Go in there and be very businesslike until Christmas. About Christmas, you know, just as they're going away on vacation, you can try a weak smile and say, Merry Christmas, men. But be careful. I was so scared when I went into that classroom, and I was hoping I would remember my own name. But I went in and I was going to be very businesslike, and I could think of only one person. Me. The big question that was throbbing inside of me is, am I going to make it? Will they pants me? Oh, my God, it was just terrible. And all I could think about was me. Am I going to be a success? Oh, I wanted to be a success. And I didn't care what means I used. I would be sarcastic. I would be mean. I would even threaten people. But I had to pass that test. I could think only of me. Because I had pain. I had pain inside of me. I wasn't sure of myself. This is a big test. My whole life as a Jesuit is probably going to be mostly involved with teaching. And what if it turns out that I'm a real bomb at teaching? What do I do then? Apply for the foreign missions? So I was really insecure, and all I could think about was me. And I couldn't love those boys. And about 2 years ago, one of the classes that I taught had a reunion, and they asked me to say a few words. Well, I never really say a few words, but they thought I could. And I remember for 20 years, I wanted to go back and apologize to them. Because I really didn't love you. I was so busy being a success. I was so worried about me. And I ask you to understand that. I understand myself. I'm not ripping my heart out and saying how bad I was. I'm simply stating the fact. I wish I had loved you more. And so when they asked me to say a few words, I got up and I said, men, you won't believe this, but I'm waiting 20 years to say this to you. For all the meanness and the sarcasm and the times I pulled rank and humiliated you, hey, I'm really sorry. For all the bumps on your head and all the bruises on your egos, I'm sorry. And they all laughed. They thought I was joking, I guess. Everybody had a few snifters. And I said, hey, don't laugh. Don't laugh, or I'll have to wait 20 more years to come back at your next reunion and tell you again, I'm really sorry that I'm sorry that I didn't love you. Love you more anyway. I think I was interested, but I was mostly concerned about me. And now, and I don't mean that I have acquired great capacity for love. I'm always trying to learn how to love more. But when I walk into a classroom, I know, you will excuse me for one moment of vanity, I'll never do it again, I know I'm a good teacher. And so I don't have to worry about that. Now the pain is gone, and I can love the students I have. I can really love them. And when I walk into a classroom, my classes average between 40 and 50. If any one person in that classroom isn't feeling well physically or has some emotional problem, I can tell. I know. And I usually ask that person as he's going out of class, how are you today? Because the attention, when I had all that pain inside of myself, all that insecurity, all that fear, don't smile till Christmas, be careful, these adolescents will run away with you. I couldn't be myself. I was constantly wanting to succeed. It was a power struggle. But now I can love. The insecurity is largely gone. I can love them. I can watch them. I can say, hey, what do you need? When some student contradicts me, in the old days I would have had to crush him into pulp. Now I'm secure enough and loving enough to say, tell me what you mean by that. Tell me some more. I'm ready to listen. I'm ready to love. What do you need? So that the posture of love, if you accept this as a life principle, whoever you meet, wherever you go, all you're asking, if you're a real Christian, is, what do you need? What can I be for you? If you need me to be tough, I'll be tough. Love isn't always sweet. When my present students try to con me, you know, they don't want to turn in a term paper, or give me a break on this, or could you overlook this? I say, oh, no, I'm sorry, I just can't do that. I can be tough, because I think that's best for them. I think that that's the way they learn responsibility. The corners can be cut, but not here. But I think now, for the most part, when I'm tough, for the most part, this is not universal, I think they know I'm doing it because I love you. Because I really care for you. And so if I let you use your flim-flam on me, you know, that's not good for you at all. No, I'm going to give you somebody to bump into. If you ask me, hey, do I have to go to Mass on Sunday? Oh, sure you do. Yeah, you should be there. I'm not going to sell out to make your life more comfortable. I'll be tough. But I'm always going to be asking, if I'm a loving person, what do you need? Because I'll try to be it. Some night you'll be in the mood when you just want to talk. You've got a lot on your mind. I'll listen. And some nights you just want to be alone, and I'll leave you alone. But there are two things, if you're going to be a loving person, there are two things that all people need. Love imposes, once you accept love as your life principle, as Jesus did, it imposes a lot of decisions on you. Because you always have to be watching the person, and the loving person is constantly asking, what do you need today? I'll try to be it. I'll try to fulfill that need for you. Insofar as I'm able to, I'd like to. And unconditionally, I'm for you. I'll be tough if you need me to be tough. I'll be sweet. I'll be anything that you need. That I think you need, I will be. All right? But there are two things I think that everyone needs, and they need it constantly. And one is a sense of his own worth. Whatever I do that is done out of love, it should leave you with a sense of your own worth. Now, I may disagree with you. I may confront you. I may be tough. But I've got to be communicating at the same time a sense of your worth, because the self-image, the sense of personal worth, is the source of all human behavior, of all moods, of all mental health, of all emotional health. If a person has that, everything else seems to harmonize in his life, if he really believes in his own worth. When you cut a person down, how could you say that, you idiot? When you look at a person, hey, get away, will you? I'm busy. I've had a hard day at the office. What you're really saying to a child is, you have no worth. All rights in this family are mine. This is our house. We're letting you live here. And what you're really saying to a child is, you have no worth. And when you really want to punish a person for a lifetime, you really want to destroy a person, tell him that. Tell him he has no worth. Because everything else will follow in a pattern of destruction, of self-destruction. So in trying to decide what is the most loving thing, I'm not out for pleasure, I'm not out for power, I'm not going to let life roll over me and let fate of some sort decide what my life will be. I'm going to decide it. And I'm going to accept with you, Jesus, as my life principle, loving service. So whoever I meet and wherever I meet them, I'm going to be asking this question, what do you need me to be? What do you need me to say to you? Do you need me to leave you alone? I must decide these things in order to love you. So I'll be watching you with the eyes of love. I'll follow you. I'll watch all your movements as best I can, and I'll keep my attention out there on you and act accordingly. But in doing this, I am going to try to leave you with a sense that you are very valuable to me, and you are very valuable in yourself, and you are very good. You know, they say that if you praise a person for right activity, it is infinitely more effective than blaming him or punishing him for wrong activity. Blame and punishment almost always threaten a person's sense of self-worth. So if your kid comes home late and you make a big deal out of it, you aren't trustworthy. I can't count on you. You're no good. Get away from me. I can't stand the sight of you. What you're really saying in your little tantrum is a very destructive thing. You have no worth. I wouldn't treat someone of worth like that. Not the way I'm treating you. That's what the child hears. You don't mean that, of course, but that's what the child hears. And they say that the time he does come home on time, that's the time to act. Praise, the positive reinforcements of conduct are infinitely more effective. Say, I see you're home on time. Thanks a lot. What a fine young man you are. I can really count on you. Hey, you're all right, buddy. This is infinitely more effective than blaming him. Whereas, for some nutty reason, although all psychologists know this, and all teachers must have sometime been told this in their training, we don't do it. When a kid comes home on time, we say, what do you want me to do, a backflip? Want me to get up on the desk and jump off because you came home on time? You want a medal or something? That's what you're supposed to do. You take that for granted. But when he does the wrong thing, then you come down with both feet. And this always tends to destroy that sense of self-worth that is the most important possession a person could have. So if you really want to love somebody, if you really want to let Jesus live in you, you've got to keep asking, what is your need? But I assure you that the overall need of every human being is a sense of self-esteem, of his own worth. You have to stand in front of him like a full-length mirror and reflect back to him, hey, you're really good. You really are. The other thing, the second thing that I think you can presume in trying to love other people that they really need, and get ready for this, is you. They need you to reveal yourself to them, because there's no gift of self without the gift of self-disclosure. You've got to tell them where you hurt, where you ache, where you bleed, where you rejoice. There's no gift that you could give a wife or children or parents. There's no greater gift than this, than me. I want to not ventilate, not manipulate, but to communicate, to share myself with you. I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to tell you how I feel deep down in my guts. Oh, and when I do put out my feelings for you, oh, be gentle. This is the deepest part of me. Take my confidence in gentle hands. So, in accepting love as a life principle, by this shall men know that you are my disciples, that you love one another. This is the badge of the Christian. This is the thing that Jesus said summarizes all laws and everything, that you love one another. And this means that we have to ask, according to our capacity and our time and our abilities, we have to ask this question, what can I do for you? What do you need me to be? What would be the best thing for you, for your well-being, for your security, for your happiness? But the two things all human beings need, like breath in their lungs and blood in their veins, they need a sense of their own worth, and they need you. Unfortunately, when we get our Gospels, we get them in terms of legality. And we get 10 commandments. Thou shalt honor thy father and thy mother. Thou shalt do this. Thou shalt not do that. Everything comes to us like a legal commandment. And there's a punishment if you don't do it, right? And it's a bad mistake. It's really bad. We really ought to rewrite those. Because what God is really saying in His commandments is, will you do this for me? They are really requests. And I don't know if you know this, but when you offer a favor to a person, it's not as hard as asking a favor of a person. Because when you ask of a person, you run the risk of rejection. If I offer you help and you say, no, I can do it myself, I'm not rejected. But if I say, would you help me, and you say no, then I'm rejected. So what do you think of those commandments of God? Would you think of them, learn to think of them as requests? That God is putting Himself on the line. He's counting on you. And He's saying, you know, your wife, your children, your parents, they really need to be loved. You're nobody till somebody loves you. Will you love them for me? Jesus hangs on His cross. We keep the symbol up before our eyes of the crucifix. And under every crucifix, they ought to have a sign. This is what I mean when I say I love you. Look, all I ask of you is forever to remember me as loving you. Greater love than this no man has, than he would lay down his life for those he loves. I have loved you. By this shall men know that you are my disciples, that you will love one another. Will you love them for me?